Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help.
When I was young. Hello and welcome to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and at his luscious home studio at the lake, George P. Fraser, a man who is elevated sitting on the couch as a high art. George, welcome.
That's true, Bill.
It's very true.
You know, the recliners are a whole nother deal, and we can talk about that someday on the show,
yeah,
too. So are you doing well?
I am doing well. I heard your dog ordered noise cancellation headphones.
Probably.
Not, and
there's
not,
packages
and not,
that
and
show
not,
up every day.
And they're not for you. They're for him.
Yeah.
I don't know what that says.
Probably something to do with him more than me, Bill, I'm sure. So let's just move right along here. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we've got a
looking
great
forward to tonight.
Yeah, we have a great show. Billy's going to be joining us on the program a little bit later. But for now, it's always good to catch up and do a step. I think step one is a good step to address tonight. And that is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable.
Yeah, well read.
Thank you.
And we look to scripture, and one of those slogans that I used to just hate in recovery, and I've come to see a lot of wisdom, is first things first. And that's step one. And the origin, as far as I can tell, of first things first is Matthew 6:33. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. And I kind of wanted to start there. I got a little nostalgic this week, Bill. Our first producer, Alex Whitworth, is now a father, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the picture of Alex and his family, I thought about the beginning of our show. But 9 years ago, and all the things that God has taught us since then, and how God has been very faithful to us, and how we're all 9 years older, thanks to
mm-hmm.
God.
Right.
And now, I didn't say 9 years more mature, Bill. I said we're older and want to keep it real on Real Recovery. But one of the things that I'm learning ties in with a lot of the phone conversations I've had this week about the COVID and staying close to God and staying sober. And I think it starts with how hard this is for a lot of us. It gets dark very early.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Bob, my dog, earlier. You know, Bob used to go to bed at about 8:30, and now it's 7:30 because the sun goes down and he's got about an hour or two left. It's fooled him. But for a lot of us in recovery, the seasonal affective disorder is a problem. I don't know why the correlation is, but we get sad this time of year, and we're not going outside, and we have restrictions, and our accountability groups, maybe we're Zooming instead of attending in person, and maybe that's the same way at church and in our Bible study, and the contacts are less and less. And if you build a recovery support group, the solid, sober social support group, you need to see people. And for a lot of us, when we see other people, Bill, it's Jesus with flesh on it, mm-hmm. if they're Christian recovery people. And I know I'm not getting that, and I can talk on the phone to people, but I'm hearing from people that they have to make a decision every day whom they're going to serve. You know, as for us, we choose to serve the Lord, but what good things do I have instead of things that I don't have or I used to have or I'm not able to do? That really, the more people I talk to, and I recognize this, Bill, I have to make a decision every day to be grateful, to be truthful and go, hey, I might not go to meetings. I might not go to Lifetime. I might not play golf. I might not want to spend a lot of time outside, but I'm sober, I'm saved, and I'm not sick yet, mm-hmm. all through the grace of God. And where that ties into step one, we are powerless over everything. Our next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. And when we look at that and we realize that he created us and that he numbered our days before we took one breath, it takes a lot of pressure off. And we go from being panicked and maybe a little depressed and not joyful to grateful. And the process of that is how we walk out our faith, or as we say on Real Recovery, how we work our program. And one of the blessings to a lot of people I've talked to, and I know for me, Bill, is that I am really forced to focus on my program of my relationship with Christ that I do by the 12 steps. More so now than ever, because I'm not on autopilot, because it's hard. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of loss. And I think we need to recognize that loss, but also factor in all the things God has given us. And this too will pass, as my mom used to say.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the unmanageability that you find in step one, when you have a life that is focused on self-centeredness and kind of an egocentric sort of world, and you can't connect with other people and be in community, it does make that more challenging and difficult, I think, to your point.
Yeah, I'm real big on unmanageability. I've kind of made that a key word of my lifestyle, Bill. And what you realize is my way doesn't work. His way does. And when you wake up, I talk about this a lot, I pray for sobriety before I get out of bed. But how does God want me to live today? And for me, one of the things that sharpened me a little bit is my options are limited now, Bill. And sometimes that's good.
Mm-hmm.
That got to do a real strong quiet time, right?
Right.
Because you got to get focused here.
I think, George, what I hear you say is you get up in the morning and basically you're saying to God, you're worthy and I'm needy. And he is worthy of your blessing and your praise, and he is the source of your gladness, and he gives you the strength to stay sober throughout the day. And you take that one day at a time. I've heard you say that for years now.
Yeah, for me, it's a lot simpler, and thank you for that. It's kind of help. I'm awake now. What do I do?
Because
automatically my mind is going. And I need to get some direction. And I think in times like this, I've heard that there's been a lot more overdoses lately and suicides. And people you talk to, if you can ask them how they're really doing, they're going to tell you they're struggling.
Mm-hmm. So we always have to be mindful of who is in our circle of influence that might feel and might be more vulnerable than others, to make sure we're doing our very best to reach out to them, let them know they matter, we care about them, and we love them.
Absolutely, Bill. I think now we have to make a real conscious effort to reach out to people and call them. And maybe you can't see them, but you can sure talk to them on the phone or Zoom or do a Microsoft meeting, whatever. There's ways to do it. And when you were using, I would drive 2 hours to get cocaine, so I can take 5 minutes to make a phone call.
Mm-hmm. Great point. So as we look back from what we talked about earlier on 10 minutes ago, that step one is where you begin. You admit that you're powerless over drugs and alcohol or whatever sin is causing you to be addicted and that your life has become unmanageable. So if you're sitting there hearing these words from George and I, and you're thinking, yep, that's me. My life is unmanageable right now. And that nail just got hit on the head. That is the perfect place to start this journey. And tonight you can start this journey by putting your faith and trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. I think, George, the story that Billy has tonight is going to be a powerful testimony to transformation.
I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. So that's the program. If you are a new listener to Real Recovery and your friend recommended you listen to us, I hope you still like that friend at the end of the hour. You can go to myfaithradio.com and go to the Real Recovery webpage and see all the episodes there. We have them in podcast form. You're welcome to help yourself. We'll take a little break when we come back. Billy is our guest. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Excited that we've got an opportunity to talk to our guest Billy today. He's got quite a story, George. We always say, we never get tired of hearing stories of transformation, and today is going to be no exception.
Yeah, I always look forward to this, so I can't wait to hear it.
Thank you. So, because I think I think our audience is very ready for us to stop and for Billy to start. Let's welcome him onto the program. Billy, welcome.
Glad to be here today.
Thank you so much. Now, as always, and I know you listen to the show, so you kind of know the drill. We want to hear about how, where, and how you grew up, and was there family life, good, bad, a little bit of both? Was there a church involved? What was that like?
So I grew up in Ocean City, Maryland, beach town. Grew up surfing, skating.
Nice.
Great family life. I would consider myself a spoiled little rich kid that went bad. Private schools.
Yeah.
All the best opportunities in the world. Was quite an athlete.
Okay.
Played lacrosse at the highest level. Played for Division I team, Adelphi University, back in Long Island. And bounced around the indoor league for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But made a lot of bad decisions along the way.
Okay. So had a pretty good family life and things were good. And when did you start to experiment? Was it in high school?
Right around the end of middle school, early high school.
Okay.
Just made some bad choices. Saw guys smoking pot, drinking, doing the partying thing.
Yeah.
And I kind of got sucked in.
Yeah.
And kind of filled a void in my life that I didn't know I had.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran to that for quite a long time. First attempt at trying to get my act together was the end of my senior year of high school, or actually the beginning of my senior year of high school. I was hospitalized in a dual diagnosis program for 90 days. And at that point in my life, I stayed clean for about 5 years, but it really wasn't a faith journey. It was a very prideful journey.
Mm-hmm.
It was one where, look at me, I'm only 19 and I'm sober and I'm going to take the world bull by the horns. And but had a kind of tragic ending a few years later when I bumped my head. And after that, then I had a series of God events, is what I would call them. I wasn't much into the church growing up. Religion was a duty. It wasn't about a relationship with the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
We were what I would consider good Catholics, CEOs, mm-hmm. Christmas and Easter only type folks.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a situation where I had moved back to the beach. Had a great upbringing, but I was never super close to my dad. My dad, workaholic, really driven individual, highly successful. So I moved back to the beach and took a job in his accounting firm. But taking that job was a radical, radical change in my lifestyle, because prior to that, I'd been managing bars and nightclubs. I was making a lot of money. I was pretty successful. And my dad's a little bit old school, and mm-hmm. he determined that you start at the bottom, so you're a $10 an hour bookkeeper, and you're going to go to school and get your CPA. And going from making six figures to making $10 an hour, that's a radical change in your lifestyle.
A very big change in lifestyle. And the other lifestyle had a little bit of glamour to it, didn't it?
I had some fun times.
Yeah.
Not everything I did was morally incorrect or horrific. I mean, I met a lot of neat people. At one time, I managed a bar in Baltimore right by Camden Yards.
Okay.
So I met a lot of the Orioles in the late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Still friends with some of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And some really neat experiences along the way. But I sabotaged all that with my lifestyle choices. The use of cocaine at that point had become normal. That was like everyday life. And where it really, really took a turn for the worse was when I started smoking crack. And I'd like to call the 3 years of doing that the 3 years of hell.
Mm-hmm.
I went from having a desire to play sports, to surf, to play golf, being the life of the party, to being pretty much a recluse. I worked and I sat in a house and smoked crack around the clock.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved back to the beach, that pattern followed me. And here I am working for my dad. I'm not in a job that I enjoyed. I was in a position that I was sitting behind a desk, and I'm not a sit behind a desk kind of guy. And I wasn't using the skills that I think God had given me to help his business grow and prosper. And it was a very difficult time. There was a lot of verbal fighting, a lot of anger and rage from me because I was just hurt that I was being paid such a little bit of money and I was used to making a lot more money. And along the lines, while I was working there, I'd wiped out all my worldly resources. And during that time, I started to embezzle money from one of my father's clients. And it got easier and easier and easier. Each time I got away with it, I didn't have the fear anymore of writing a check and going and cashing it and then going and getting drugs. It got so bad that my main dealer would actually come to the accounting office. He had an accounting textbook that we had hollowed out that he could put drugs in. And he would come to the office and pretend that he was getting accounting tutoring to deliver my drugs. And I would walk right down the hallway, right into the bathroom and smoke crack, right while I'm in the middle of a work day.
Hmm.
And about that same time, though, the gentleman who made my surfboards for me had become a new believer. And he was one of those new believers that wanted to evangelize everybody. Everybody needed to be saved. And
I like this guy already.
Yeah. John was a great influence, and he was making a couple surfboards for me, and a big swell was coming, and he wouldn't give me my surfboards until I went to church. And he basically held him hostage. And I remember sitting on the beach watching a great swell without a board to ride. So I said, I'll check this church thing out. And I'm a little skeptical, a little analytical. So he said, just come for Wednesday night fellowship. Now, you got to understand, my context is Catholic Mass, do your duty, take your communion, run out the door, and live like everybody else the rest of the week. I'm like, Wednesday night, church? So I remember pulling in the parking lot of the Ocean City Worship Center, and I sat there the first night, didn't even walk in the door, and I wrote down names of people that I knew and knew how they at least used to live, and went and interviewed them. And every one of them had a story of how Jesus had transformed their life, how they accepted Jesus as their Savior, and that they were living for the Lord. They weren't doing the things they used to do. And it was the first time I could experience and witness tangible transformation. These were people I knew how they used to live, and now they were living for the Lord. And I'd like to say that the first night I walked in that church, I got saved, but I'm a slow study.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first night, people lifting their hands and the band playing, and it was an Assembly of God church right in the middle of when Brownsville Revival was going on. So revival had come to that church. And at that time, I just knew that there was something there, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And I'd like to say that the 6 months I spent there before giving my heart to the Lord, they were interesting, but I became so hypocritical. I went out and I bought a Bible, didn't even buy the right Bible. I bought the New World Translation of the Holy Scriptures because I didn't want to spend $65 on a Bible at the Christian bookstore, so I spent a quarter on a Jehovah's Witness Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm highlighting in it, I'm bringing my notebook, I'm faking the funk, I'm raising my hands at the right time, might have even taken a courtesy drop or two.
Mm-hmm.
And but the one thing that happened was Pastor Tim Dukes, who I'm still very, very close to today, poured into me. He saw something in me. He knew that I was athletic-minded. He knew that I surfed. Anytime there was something going on with sports, I was invited. And he got to know me, and a relationship formed. And I had a lot of peers and friends from growing up that were really involved in this church. It was a new church plant. And then that fall, which was the fall of 1997, Greg Hubbard, an evangelist from out east, he's a graduate of Valley Forge Christian College, came in to do what was supposed to be your Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 3-day revival meeting. So God moved. And Greg ended up being there for 3.5 months. We were in church every night. And about 3 or 4 weeks into that, I remember him giving an altar call. And I had drugs in my pocket. I had a plan to leave church and go do my thing afterwards, just like I normally did. And God was just tugging on my heart so much. And I ran to the altar. I put my drugs on the altar, and I probably wept and left a stain on that altar like I'd never wept before. Mm. Wish I could say that I was instantly delivered that night. Being in the state of mind I was, I thought the right thing to do was be like John and go evangelize. So I went right into the drug haven and started witnessing to people and telling them what God had done in my life. And about 2 weeks later, I bumped my head again. And then the worst 90 days of my life were from October 21st until January 21st, when God totally set me free. And that's a story unto itself. I spent that day in the office, did like I normally did, left the office, went to the bank, cashed a check, went, saw the drug dealer, picked up a large amount of cocaine. I was going to smoke all night long. And I don't necessarily recommend this, but I was driving past the church, and I hadn't been there in a couple weeks. And two people from church had stopped by my office to ask, check on me, mm-hmm. How you doing, da-da-da-da-da. And I gave them some story. We're busy at work, just haven't been able to make it to worship. And that night, I pulled into the parking lot of the church and put a cassette in the tape player from the evangelist that preached the night I was saved. And the message was the bowels of betrayal, the story of Judas. And I will never forget him giving the altar call on that tape, because I was driving down Route 50, headed eastbound right towards the beach where I lived, and sitting at a light, and he gave that altar call, and it was as if God met me right there. And I pulled over on a side road, and I kind of had a Jacob-type wrestling match with God. Like, I got out of the car, and it's January. It's cold. Not cold Minnesota cold, but cold enough. And I'm laying on the ground, and I'm just begging God to set me free. And that probably went on for 30, 35 minutes, and I stood up, and I knew that something had happened. I drove home, flushed an ounce of cocaine down the toilet, opened my Bible, and I always knew that I'd heard it so many times. Get into the Gospels, read the book of John, emulate the life of Jesus. So I think I read the Gospel of John like three times that night, and I finally fell asleep. And the next morning, I woke up to my dad calling me, screaming at me for not being at the office. And when I got to the office that day, the only thing I said to my father was, I need help. And that was kind of my buzzword of, like, I'm checking out. I'm either going to another treatment center, I'm going to a mental institution. Mm-hmm. Parents drove me home, and a lot happened after that.
Yeah, well, let's find out what happened after that. We'll take a little break. You were listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Our guest Billy's in studio, and we're hearing all about his story. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Try to see things my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, on the risk of knowing that my love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still think that it's all right.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo.
Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. We've got an amazing story going on tonight. Our guest Billy has got quite a story. George, I know you got a follow-up question or two from the first last segment.
Yeah, gosh, Billy, that was great. I want to go way back. I believe you said you went to a dual diagnosis treatment, and it sounded like that was your first treatment. What was the diagnosis there besides addiction?
Bipolar disorder.
Okay.
Today, I wouldn't say that that's an accurate diagnosis. I would say that later in life, I was diagnosed with adult ADHD, and my wife would affirm that diagnosis wholeheartedly, mm-hmm. and my marriage has been saved by exploring that when I was working on my master's degree.
So when you went to treatment the first time, did you have some sobriety after that?
I stayed clean for 5 years after that. But it was really white knuckle and very prideful. I was the youngest person in 12-step meetings. I had a lot of pats on the back and actually stayed clean throughout my first trip to college. I went back to school later in life, but my first trip to college, I was clean through that whole time, which was a little bit of a oddball scenario because most of my teammates were running off to parties and stuff, and I was running off to 12-step meetings.
Wow.
No, that's really impressive is what that is. And then did you think after 5 years sobriety, hey, maybe I was young, maybe I didn't have a problem? Is that why you went back? Or
Part of it was maybe I was so young, but the other part of it was I was working in an environment that was conducive to drug and alcohol use. I was tending bar and waiting tables, and everybody else partied, so maybe I can try it. And gave it a little swing of the bat, and I fouled it off miserably.
Yeah, you know, I've worked with a lot of people that are in the hospitality industry, and they tell me they get addicted to the lifestyle, too. Was that part of it for you?
Definitely was. I loved working nights and being up all hours of the night. It was always like the life of the party, the scenario. I lived in a beach resort town, so there was always activity going on in the summer. And the winters back then, we kind of called it doing the tour because it was a resort town that went from 300,000 people down to about 6,000 people in the off season. So there was specific bars where all the industry, hospitality industry people went on specific nights. So Monday night was the Green Turtle, Tuesday night was BJ's, Wednesday night was Fager's. And you just kind of got in a rut and a routine, and that rut and routine led to devastation.
It's interesting that you were still in search of community and fellowship. I mean, that's at the heart of all of it, isn't it?
Big time extrovert. My Myers-Briggs would be
to
the extreme E.
Yeah, no, that's a good thing.
And God's used that for his glory.
Absolutely.
In many, many ways. I don't do well as a loner. I need to be in environments where there's community, where there's fellowship, where there's biggest thing for me is probably accountability today. I've always had a group of three, I call them, based on Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 12, where it says two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of used that as a foundational life verse over the years of always having guys in my life that can speak truth. And we have a covenant of integrity and honesty. And at one time, I read a book, Character Counts by Rod Hanley. And I took 10 questions out of that book that I've kind of tweaked over the years. But they're the 10 questions I ask with my accountability partners once a week. We sit down. Now we do it over Zoom, of course, in the times we live in today, but we're over the phone. But we're able to look each other in the eye and share our struggles, share the struggles that men have. How are we doing with our finances? Are we operating above reproach? Is our face in the book? And when you have that kind of relationship, it really helps you grow and mature in the Lord. And it also, you need people that can speak life into those hard places because we can get blinded by things. Even today, I'm not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I pastored for 15 years and I certainly made my share of errors from the pulpit and in ministry. But having people that you trust and that can pour into you and hold your feet to the fire has been a life-changing part of my journey.
When you talk about these questions you ask to your accountability group, does it involve things like finances, or do you have a couple of questions from that book you can share with the listeners?
One of them is, are you being above reproach with your finances? Are you being faithful in giving? Another part has a lot to do with sexual temptation.
Mm-hmm.
Are you being faithful to your spouse or your loved one? Have you looked at any lustful things? Fortunately, that's not an area that I've ever really had any struggles with, but over the years, it seems like always one of us in our group has had struggles with either pornography or gambling or other things that can derail us when we're seeking to honor Christ and walk like Christ walked.
Yeah. So these questions really are just the direct approach.
Mm. Yes.
Which probably
I'm not Midwest. I'm from the East Coast.
Yeah. So that is probably the best way to just be accountable is just be real direct.
Direct and the covenant of honesty and integrity that we all sign is a very powerful moment, because there's been guys that I've been in that relationship with that, you know, are kind of faking the funk and shucking and jiving, and you want to do everything you can for them, but you don't want to hold their hand and lead them to destruction thinking they're all right.
Mm-hmm. George, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's very interesting, and I'm a big guy, Billy, on, you know, don't tell me, show me. And I think the real key here is the accountability groups, where you have permission to give people feedback, to tell them what you're seeing. And, you know, we all have enough people in our lives that tell us how great we're doing in that. And a real friend is somebody who's going to say, hey, you know, you're falling short here, brother. What are you going to do about it? And I really like that. I would like to go back, because it was very interesting to me how you went into your office that day with your dad and said, I needed help. And obviously you got help. I'm wondering what you did and how you handled the embezzlement. How did that ever work out?
Well, that's a miracle unto itself. The day that I left the office, I went home. And I was supposed to go check into the hospital. I called up my therapist, and he was going to have me emergency petitioned. I was going to sign myself in willfully. And I missed my ride. And I woke up many hours later, and I was panicked. And my pastor was out of town. He was on a missions trip. And I ended up paging the youth pastor and the youth pastor's wife, who was not equipped to deal with somebody who was out of their mind like I was. I think I scarred her. We're good friends today, but we love to tell the story because she was very overwhelmed as I was telling her all these things I did. And that night I ended up in the hospital, and a friend of mine took me there, and he looked at me after I told him what I had done, and he said, if you don't confess this and you try and carry this around, you'll probably go back to the way you were. He said, I believe it's Proverbs 26:11, as a dog returns to its vomit, a fool returns to his folly.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack basically said, I can't tell you what to do, because if you confess, you might go away for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, you might die. So that was kind of very real. And that when I got upstairs to the psych ward, a social worker I'd known from when I had gotten my degree as an addictions counselor saw that I was carrying a Bible. And she's a large African-American woman. And she said, praise God, Billy Frick's got a Bible. And I shared the same story, and she shared the same exact thing. So that night, with a lot of weeping and praying, I determined to call my father and confess to this money that nobody knew was missing. And I called my dad the next morning. I told him to sit down at my computer. He told him a spreadsheet that was hidden in an encrypted code that calculated all the money I had stolen. And when he looked at it, he's like, what is this? And I said, Dad, that's all the money I've stolen. And I got to get it right. And he said, call me back in an hour. I called him back in an hour. And at that point, we were cut off. He said, the next people you'll hear from is the authorities. So I went from the psych ward to a short-term rehab, got out of the rehab, calling the police station every day to see if there's a warrant out for my arrest. I'm ready to turn myself in, and rode my bike home from a 12-step meeting, and I'm sitting in my house, got a Bible in my lap, and they came about 20 deep to my house to take me away. And the irony of all ironies is the person who led that is my wife's ex-husband. So I've sat next to the man who arrested me at two different weddings, and I've been married to my wife coming up on 19 years. And God rest his soul, he was a bitter man and never saw the light, unfortunately. But I ended up going to jail, spent about 6 months in the Worcester County Detention Center, facing over 600 years federal time. I had a public defender. We like to refer to him when you're a prisoner as a public pretender because they don't do much for you. Basically represented myself. But in that time, my pastor came to me and said, what about Teen Challenge? And I was familiar with Teen Challenge because I'd seen their choir sing in our church. And I'll never forget when I saw the choir sing in my church, I remember saying to myself, I'm glad I'm not as bad as them. Well, I was probably every bit as bad, if not worse. And when it came time for my sentencing, I had a capped sentence where I could get no more than 10 years prison time. And when it came time for sentencing, Pastor Tim spoke on my behalf, Pastor Dick, my spiritual father, who went to be with the Lord a few years ago. And there was this long pause. There was about a five-minute pause where you could hear shuffling papers. And Judge Bloxham had been just hanging people that day. Everybody was walking out with a broken neck. And I was sure I was getting 10 years that day. And he looked up and he said, I don't know why I'm going to do this today, but I'm going to let you go. And the courtroom erupted. And he's banging the gavel, order, order, order. And then he proceeded to say, I don't think you're going to make it. And when you don't make it, you're going to do this sentence day for day. I'm giving you an 8-year suspended sentence, 100% restitution. Condition was I had to complete Teen Challenge. I had the highest level of parole and probation when I got out of Teen Challenge. And I had this burden of 2 years to pay nearly $100,000 back and not the ability to pay it back.
Wow. Yeah, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to hear more about what happened.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
All right, we are back. Welcome back. I know it's the break we just took. You were tapping your fingers, thinking how long before we get back to this story. I can't wait any longer. Well, here we are. So, Billy, let's pick up where you left off, because you've got your situation now where you have to pay back a very large sum of money, and you don't know how you're going to do it.
At that point, going through the whole trial, it's important to know that once my dad cut me off, there was virtually no contact. He actually testified against me in the court hearings, but by the time I got to sentencing, he did stand up and read a statement saying, I don't know that jail's going to help my son. Maybe this God thing, this Teen Challenge thing, might help him. So he was willing to allow me to be released. I went on to Teen Challenge, and that was it's challenged for a reason. I was under the old school model of Teen Challenge, where I watched guys laying on the couch detoxing from heroin. I was at the Capitol Heights Center right outside of D.C. Then I went on to the original God's Mountain to finish my training phase. And that whole time for me, Teen Challenge was a great experience. And God used a lot of my business skills and things. I worked in the ministry. And I kind of thought that I had a lifelong calling to that ministry. About a month before I graduated, I got a letter from my dad sharing that he had come to know Jesus in a personal way. And that he couldn't wait to be at my graduation. And that although things would be different, it was years before I had a key to their house or felt comfortable around my mom and dad, because there was always this kind of air of, is he going to go off the rails again? Happy to say that 21 years later, none of that now. So I graduate Teen Challenge, and I read a portion of the letter from my dad and during my testimony, because I was one of the two students picked to share my story. And it was a powerful, powerful moment. And I went back to my hometown, Ocean City, Maryland, which a lot of times they talk about changing people, places, and things. But I thought I needed to go back to Ocean City at least for a season. And originally I thought I was only going to be there for 90 days. And I got hired as a missionary to work in this homeless shelter, Diaconia, and lived there. So I had almost the same kind of accountability that I had in Teen Challenge, except now I did have some freedom where I could go out. But I wasn't making a whole lot of money as a missionary at a homeless shelter.
Mm-hmm.
I was making $100 a week stipend. But I did have my housing covered. I had an apartment upstairs. I did have to sleep in the dorms with the residents couple nights a week, and then a couple nights I slept on the couch doing the overnight. And about halfway through my 90-day commitment to there, I really felt God's tugging at my heart that he was going to make a way for me to go to Bible college instead of just going back to Teen Challenge. And about that time, I went to my boss, and I asked her if there was any possibility of me extending my stay. And she said, "That's interesting you should say that. The housing manager just put in a resignation. We think you'd be a great housing manager." And so that kind of confirmed that there was a spot for me. And about a week later, I met with my pastor once a week at the time. He told me to ride my bike, don't drive the shelter's van to come to our accountability session. He said, "Don't ride your bike, get dropped off." And I got there, and we started driving away from town. We weren't going towards one of the restaurants, and we ended up at the MVA, and he said, "By the way, we're registering this car for you, and then we're enrolling you at Christian World College of Theology. This car is yours. Insurance is going to be taken care of for 3 years, and your tuition's paid for in full." I still to this day don't know who blessed me with that car, put a lot of miles on that car for the good of the gospel. And prior to that, I told my mom I thought I was going to go to Bible college, and my mom was still very bitter at this point. And I remember her saying, "Now you're hustling people in the name of the Lord. Aren't you some stuff?" Because I told her, I said, "I think I'm going to end up at Bible college." And she's like, "You have a bicycle. The Bible college is 40 miles away. But I kind of had a look what God did moment when I was given a car and my tuition was paid for those to go to Christian World College of Theology. And I ended up working at that homeless shelter for 5 years while I was going through Bible college. I have a lot of great memories. It was great to have that kind of high-level accountability. I had to blow in the breathalyzer when I came in at night, just like the residents. Wasn't worried about that. It was just a great environment, surrounded by people. But the unique thing was, a lot of the people that were there were guys I had been incarcerated with. And they all thought I was kind of faking the funk, playing this Jesus thing in jailhouse Christian to get a reduced sentence. But was able to lead a lot of people to the Lord because they saw the difference. And either I'm the biggest fraud in the world or Jesus is alive. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever, because 20-some years later, I'm still living for the Lord, loving the Lord. Fellowship's important. Being plugged into a local church is important. Have a great wife and family now, and God's been really faithful through all that. And probably the best thing I can say today is, although with COVID and stuff, I haven't seen my mom and dad for over a year now. They split time between Ocean City and Florida. I get a text or a phone call from my dad every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with his golf score. We talk all the time. I'm really close to my mom and dad today, even though from a distance.
That's lovely. What a great story. I'm interested, too, just when you have this moment where when God... God's glory breaks into your life and you start to realize that you are now a man being changed. You are changed, you're being changed, and you're now in a new path, and you haven't gone back 21 years later. So that transformation was profoundly real, wasn't it?
It was definitely profoundly real because I knew that when I stood up that night and I drove the rest of the way home, that God had touched me. And I've had other moments with God where I can't say that I hear God's voice audible, but there's just a few times where I can say that I really knew that I knew that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
One was coming here to Minnesota to go to work at North Central University when I came out here to coach and teach there. Probably the biggest one, though, was when I met my wife, or when we started seeing each other. And we had a pretty high-speed relationship. Our first date was December 27th, we were married August 17th the following year, and we're coming up on 19 years, and she's been a faithful intercessor and prayer warrior and helpmate, and she's just such a blessing. Diana's such a blessing in my life, and we have a wonderful 16-year-old son, and then she has two boys. I actually met my wife because I was mentoring one of her sons. He was in the youth group at the church I was saved in, and so we have a pretty neat family. Jason's in ministry, Tony works in New York, and we have a neat story. We've been all over the place, though. God has led us to many places, including the frozen tundra of Minnesota.
Yeah, not all bad, is it?
Nope.
All right, Georgie, what do you got for him?
You know, I just think it's a great story of hope for somebody listening that's struggling, that you know, you didn't give up, and God shows up for us and you yielded to it. And you can't argue with the facts here. 20 years is 20 years. Good for you.
Really appreciate that.
Again, George, I concur, and I'm excited to hear again another story where the transformation takes place, and it's you did have a little, you called it bumped your head. Is that a little way of saying I relapsed?
No, I've never relapsed in those 20 years.
No, not in those 20, but in the, you had 5 years sobriety,
went back, had about a year.
Okay, yeah.
I had about a four-year window where I was on a rocky, a winding road, you might say.
You were white knuckling it in those
during
that
time. Yeah, and it wasn't working.
Yeah. And the restoration has happened with your dad and your mom, and it's really a remarkable story. They don't all end up this way.
Certainly not. I've been blessed to see God restore some families. I've also been with people who are heartbroken because their families haven't been restored. And I'm just thankful that I have a relationship with my mom and dad today that only with Christ would that be possible.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about your work now, what God's laid on your heart to do. I know you stay in close fellowship. I think the Zoom meetings that you're a part of and the accountability is really great. Do you get a chance to do some one-on-one mentoring as well?
I actually was able to go on to seminary and ended up getting a master's in social work and a master's in divinity from Palmer Theological Seminary. I served as a pastor and a therapist for years. Today, I'm still actively involved in the Teen Challenge program. I don't have a mentee right now because of COVID, but I usually have one or two students that I'm mentoring. And I also am a certified interventionist, so I still get calls to do interventions there. They look a little different than they used to because of the state that we live in now. But I've shared my story. There was a time early on in my walk where before I was a pastor, when I was just the guy filling pulpits every now and then, where I got tired of coming to the church and immediately getting latched onto by whoever was introducing me and saying, you're gonna share all the blood and guts because we brought all the drug addicts and alcoholics here today. They need to hear your story. And it kind of got to the point where I haven't shared my story like this in a long, long time because God's done so much since then.
Mm-hmm.
But I know it's a story that needs to be told at the right time. And, of course, when I'm mentoring new believers or people that are coming out of those strongholds, I share the bits and pieces as needed to give them hope. And it's just amazing how Christ has been so faithful through every twist and turn. I mean, we've lived all over the place. I've pastored in two different states. I've worked for a parachurch ministry at one time. Today, I'm kind of in a state of transition.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working at a golf course up until recently, but for the first time in my life, I think I'm actually going to take a 9-to-5 type job. I have an interview tomorrow, but I always have a heart for the marginalized, the oppressed, the downtrodden, and want to breathe life into them. We need to allow our words to speak life, light, and blessings, not death, darkness, and curses, and need to be salt and
Billy,
light.
Great story. I want to encourage you. I think anything to do with golf is God's work too.
Absolutely.
One of the things that I really think is important for people like me that are in recovery, people like us, we need to hear our stories because what we hear in our story is God did for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. and we can forget that because things start going well for us, you know?
Yeah.
And we think, gosh, I really got this going. And I'm always reminded by my many failures in life, pride comes before the fall. Let every man take heed lest he stumble.
So true. Georgia, we're out of time. I got to let you go. Billy, thanks so much for being such a great guest.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. That wraps up our show for the night. Have a great night, and we'll see you next time.
Not a perfect person. There's many things I wish I didn't do.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.